This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's have a little inspiration. Boston, Massachusetts, New England, we are a region of history, and those who make it, enlighteners, challengers of the status quo, even revolutionaries, the ways they have changed the world affect the way we live today, and sometimes what they did is also just plain cool, like cutting up and selling ice. Now, if you've ever seen that done, it was probably in the Disney film Frozen.
This icy force, both foul and fair, has a frozen harbor lining.
That'll be 40.
40? No, 10.
Oh dear, that's no good. See, this is from our winter stock. For the supply and demand to have a big problem.
You want to talk about a supply and demand problem? I sell ice for a living.
Ooh, that's a rough business to be in right now. I mean, that is really... that's unfortunate.
You'd have to go to fiction to see it, because cutting up pond ice and selling it is a thing of the past. But it was big business, and it took off after an invention by an engineer in Cambridge. Now, journalist Karen Weintraub and her husband, Michael Kukta, have a new book out that tracks all kinds of interesting ideas and people who were, according to the book's title, born in Cambridge, 400 years of ideas and innovators. We're going to talk about a few of those with her today. Karen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. So great to be here.
It's great to have you. And I kind of feel like we got to start with the ice, right? You got 400 years of innovators, but let's start right there. Nathaniel Wyeth. Now, back up a little. Tell us how selling pond ice even came to be.
Sure. So everybody in Cambridge thinks that the field originated in Cambridge. Not quite true, but Frederick Tudor had this great idea in 1806 to sell ice to people in the Caribbean because they didn't have any. And so he began shipping it down there. At first, he kept his idea a secret because he didn't want other people to steal his brilliant idea. When they found out, they laughed at him. They thought it was hilarious that anybody would try to send ice to the Caribbean by boat, obviously, in those days. They didn't think it would make it that far. Much of it melted on the way, and the rest that made it kind of confused people. They didn't know what ice was. They didn't know how to use it. He would convince bartenders to give drinks with free ice to get people hooked on cold drinks and teach them how to make ice cream. But the business was not doing well. He was in debtor's prison twice. He was in deep trouble until he met this guy named Nathaniel Wyeth, who had grown up in Cambridge on the shores of Fresh Pond. His father owned a hotel there. And Wyeth figured out how to carve giant blocks of ice out of Fresh Pond. Hard for us to imagine today that Fresh Pond was really that frozen over
right.
in those days, but it was. And he came up with this device, passing a plow pulled by horses would scrape out the squares, and then another pass would dig them out. And they were able to get these giant blocks. They put them in sawdust, and they made it in the ship's hull all the way to India, 14,000 miles away. And the British loved these guys. They said it was the greatest invention since the potato had come to Europe, because they were so happy to have cold drinks again. So he became a bit of a hero. He couldn't stay in one place very much. So Wyeth launched two expeditions to the Pacific Northwest, and actually is also considered one of the founders of Portland, Oregon. Huh. So kind of an interesting guy.
So I will say, A, I did not see the potato to ice comparison coming. So that's a new one for me. But also, so Wyeth was like an inventing machine when it came to this industry. According to the Dictionary of American Biography, quote, "It was said at his death that practically every implement and device used in the ice business had been invented by Nat Wyeth," end quote.
He was a very creative guy, and we've had a lot of them in Cambridge over 400 years, which was sort of the point of this book. Not everybody was born in Cambridge, but Wyeth was, and all the ideas that we talk about, we took a little literary license with the idea.
Yeah. All right. So listen, I actually find this industry fascinating, but we've got three women that I
yes.
want to get to. So the rest, we're going to focus on women for the rest of the time here. They butted up against limitations of their times, and they found a way to break through. And what's interesting is sometimes more subtly than at other times. So let's start with Anne Bradstreet. I want to start there because she's the furthest back in history among our group of women that we're talking about here. Tell us a little bit about her.
So she arrived in what was then called Newtown for the first 2 years of its existence in 1630.
And that was Cambridge, just for
that
people,
was
right?
Cambridge, yeah. Exactly. And in fact, we don't even know how to spell it. Everybody spelled it differently, but whether it was one word or two and how many capitals. But it was pretty wild back then. There was the river was not embanked. It was swamp. There wasn't much here. They had to cut their own trees for firewood. Half the people who arrived on the ship that she took over from England died that first winter of starvation. It was pretty miserable times. There's a Harvard gate that's named for Bradstreet, kind of facing the Science Center, and it quotes her saying, "I came to this country where I found a new world and new manners at which my heart rose." And to our ears, that sounds like she was singing, "My heart rose,
right,
thrilled to be here." But in those days, it meant it made her want to throw up.
Lovely.
So yeah, it was such a hostile, horrible place. And she got sick. She had 1630. She had a 2-year-old. She was 19 years old. She just arrived less than a year earlier, and she almost died. And instead of just kind of plowing through her miserable existence, she wrote a poem about it.
So called Upon a Fit of Sickness, right?
Sickness, exactly.
And you're going to read us a little bit of that?
A little bit. I'll read the first and last lines. So, "Twice 10-year-old, not fully told," so she was 19, "since nature gave me breath, my race is run, my thread is spun. Lo, here is fatal death. The race is run, the field is won, the victory's mine, I see. Forever known thy envious foe, the foil belongs to thee." So to our ears, it sounds a little rhymey and maybe a little simplistic, but Adrienne Rich, the poet who helped resurrect Bradstreet's reputation in the 1960s, described it as unadorned and simple. She wrote about her own illness, not some Greek tragedy or other great subjects that were the common topics in those days. And Rich says Bradstreet kind of laid the groundwork for an American form of poetry, later picked up by Whitman and Robert Frost, who also lived in Cambridge later, so that she was sort of the precursor of American poetry.
And just briefly, one of the things that struck me in reading your passage on her was this idea that there were very few forms available to her to express
exactly.
herself, and poetry was one of them.
Right. Women in those days couldn't really speak out. They couldn't. Other women were banished from the colonies for being outspoken. And so she was extremely religious. So this was sort of a praise poem to God to thank God for still being alive. And she also was insistent that this poem and the others that she didn't write, she wrote later, not in Cambridge, be published. She wanted people to hear this voice, to hear from this new world.
So then we move to a woman who did speak out. And we've got a little bit of an echo going. I just want to acknowledge that. No, it's okay, Karen, but I just want to acknowledge it. I think it's better to just note it. So Margaret Fuller, who really, you want to talk about subtle versus crashing right through. Let's talk about Margaret Fuller.
Yeah, so she was also born in Cambridge in 1810 on Cherry Street, which is between Central and Kendall Squares. Her father was a U.S. congressman and didn't have a son for a while and educated Margaret as if she were one, which she obviously did very well with that, but it also created problems for her. She was one of the best educated people, certainly in Cambridge at the time. And then she meets, as a young woman, Ralph Waldo Emerson and becomes part of the Transcendentalist movement. She edits their journal, The Dial, for which she is promised payment and never receives it. her father has passed away, her brother is younger, so she's supporting the family on her teaching and her writing. But there were very few options open to her in those days. And she writes a book in 1845 called Woman in the 19th Century about the plight of women like herself. And this is 50 or 60, just to remind you, 50 or 60 years before the suffragette movement starts. So she's really on the vanguard of women's rights.
And heavily influences some of the suffragettes,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. And then she moves to New York to work for the New York Tribune. She becomes one of the first female journalists in the country, inspirational for those of us who followed in her footsteps. And in 1848, she goes to Italy to cover the Italian Civil War. She becomes America's first foreign correspondent. And tragically, on the way back in 1850, she took the cheap seats back on a boat and then ended up sinking right off the coast of New York, off Fire Island. And most of the other passengers survived, but she and her 2-year-old son and husband passed away. And Emerson was so devastated, he sent Thoreau to look for her remains. And supposedly she had a manuscript with her, but it was never found.
That's really incredible. I mean, the idea that Emerson sent Thoreau to find the remains of a woman whose manuscript was anticipated, you know, during that time, it does give us a sense of her legacy and her influence then. I do want to leave time here. I want to make sure we talk about Mariah Baldwin, who was a woman of color who pioneered against both gender and racial barriers. So tell us about her.
Exactly. So also born and raised in Cambridge. And now there's, if you're familiar with the Baldwin School in Cambridge, that's named for her. And that is the school where she taught for many, many years. She was principal for 33 years. When she got a temporary job, she wasn't able to get a full-time job in Cambridge when she first graduated. She was hired to teach sort of an extra classroom at what was then the Agassiz School. She was beloved. She ended up teaching every year, every age in that school, and eventually being named its principal. What's unusual about that is the student body and the other faculty were almost all white. And at the time, there were, we think she was certainly the only one in New England. We think she may have been the only one almost in the country, a black woman leading a white school. She was a progressive educator. She hired the city's first school nurse, created open-air classrooms, parent-teacher group, and was really beloved. If you've heard of the poet E.E. Cummings, famous for not including punctuation, he grew up nearby, went to the school, and once wrote about her, "Never did any demi-divine dictator more gracefully and easily rule a more unruly and less graceful populace. Her very presence emanated an honor and a glory." So she was beloved and an important figure, but she also led this double life.
Right,
as a leader.
She was standing in two worlds.
Exactly. She was her home was sort of the home, I guess, for the black intelligentsia in Boston and Cambridge at the time. Her house, which still stands on Prospect Street, was a meeting place for people like W.E.B. Du Bois, civil rights pioneer, who was the first African American to receive a PhD from Harvard. Newspaper editor William Monroe Trotter would meet there and have deep conversations. Both of them went on to found the Niagara Movement, which became essentially the NAACP. So, you know, that they were really quite ahead of their time. And also that was kind of interesting that she created this setting for them to share ideas.
Did you know about all three of these women when you set out to write the book, or were they hidden from you too?
I mean, I feel ignorant that I didn't know about them, but even Margaret Fuller, a journalist, and I've been a lifelong journalist, I hadn't heard of her. There is a great biography about her that's worth reading. No, I mean, this was a voyage of discovery for both of us, and that was what made it so much fun for us and what we hope will make it fun for people to read.
And as you researched it, any connective tissue across either these women or the ideas and innovations that were born in Cambridge over 400 years?
There were a number of lessons we tried to draw in the last chapter. And one of them that I think the women we talked about sort of exemplify is that they weren't just about themselves. They were working for the greater good, for something larger than themselves. They had a mission and an ideal. And I think that obviously that's true of many people in other places, but it was consistently true over four centuries in Cambridge from among a lot of people in a lot of different fields. And I think somehow that added to the fabric of the city and enabled Cambridge to survive and thrive for so long.
Okay, and in a sentence, and you may not be able to answer this, but 400 years from now, is there anybody living in Cambridge today that you think is in the next book?
There's a lot of genetic advances going on right now that I think will pass the test of time. CRISPR-Cas9, which you've heard of, there's credit to go around, but some of it stays in Cambridge. I think that's going to be a big deal.
All right. And that is Karen Weintraub, journalist and co-author of Born in Cambridge, 400 Years of Ideas and Innovators. Her other co-author, Michael Kukta. Karen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been collectively wrestling with what you might call a state of unwellness for more than 2 years now, dodging, weaving, and for many getting hit right between the eyes by a global pandemic. So today we're starting a new bi-weekly segment called Be Well, about the many paths we can take to our own well-being. And first up, fitness. How did that go for you during the pandemic? Was fitness even a part of your life? Did you start walking or find an online fitness class? Maybe you were an essential worker, though, and your world was consumed by getting to work and working safely without room to keep your body healthy. According to a study across 14 countries published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, fitness plummeted 41% during the pandemic. And as people crawl their way back now or don't, we wanted to take a healthy look at how to get fit, where and how much to exercise, given the realities of who we are and what our lives are like. Joining us now to help, Steve McGuire, who is a self-employed personal trainer who has trained in gyms like Gymit in Boston. Steve, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you so very much for having me.
And also Amanda Palouk, an assistant professor of kinesiology at UMass Amherst. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, I want to start in a space of, this is about well-being, right? Not fierce fitness. And people might be at all kinds of fitness levels now, and they might be trying to get to all kinds of fitness levels. So with that in mind, is there a basic, hey, you should be moving your body and raising your heart rate or something pretty much this much time every week?
You know, I think we should probably limit how much we think of, you know, how often I have to work out or what I have to do, because we need to think about getting started again for a lot of people. That goal of working out X amount of times per week or how much weight we want to lose is pretty far down the road. I think people need to start where they're comfortable, and it could be starting as small as possible, as putting on your shoes and walking to the end of the block today. And if you can do that today, you can do a little bit more the next day, and we're doing what we call just forward progression, trying to get a little bit better every day. A lot of times when we have baselines, we say, you have to work out 4 days a week. If you fall short of that, if you only work out twice this week, you feel like a failure, and it might, you know, inhibit you from moving forward. So start where you're at, start slow, and just try to make some progress every single day, and know that that goal that's really far off, you know, you take small steps towards it every day, and one day you'll look up and you'll be there.
So Amanda, I'll bring you in here. And first, maybe we just define for people what kinesiology is. That's basically the mechanics of how your body moves, right?
Absolutely. So kinesiology covers, you know, the study of human movement. So when we talk about kinesiology, it's how we move and how our movement benefits our health.
And so Steve's given us that initial objective of just get started, start moving your body. And is that the end game of how we think about exercise? There are so many different objectives you can have out there, right? But at the end game, sort of the well-being of fitness is about keeping your body moving, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as an epidemiologist, what we look at is the associations of moving with health benefits. And it is showing that any more that you can move, and moving more and sitting less is going to be beneficial for our health. So wherever you're starting and moving just that little bit more can really be meaningful.
So Steve, I'm going to come back to you for a second. When we first thought maybe we would do this conversation about fitness as our first Be Well, one of the questions that had come up was, okay, it was a worker who was going back to a commute, shifting their workday, having to get from place A to place B and saying, well, what's the best time of day if I want to help my body? What's the best time of day to do fitness? And what's your answer to that, Steve?
You know, it really comes down to the individual. I personally like the 11 a.m. midday workout, but it doesn't work for a lot of people. I think whatever you want to engage in, try it. If you want to do it before work, give it a week and see if it sticks, if it's something you want to engage in. If you don't like getting up at 5 a.m. to do it before work, try it in the evening. You have to try a little bit of everything to figure out when you have the most energy, when you're the most motivated, and what has the lowest level to entry to get yourself working out.
So I love Steve's practical answer there, Amanda, because frankly, right, if you can't do it, if it doesn't work in your life, then it doesn't work in your life. I also would like to add a question about sort of metabolism and how the body works. So if one has the luxury of choosing when in the day to exercise, to get the most out of it for your health, what does our metabolism tell us?
So that's a great question. And we're still really looking into that from a scientific perspective. And really, I mean, what it comes down to is you're going to get benefits metabolically regardless of when you exercise. So I think I kind of defer to Steve's statement there in terms of whatever works best is going to be the best way to get it in. If you're not going to be able to do it in the morning, then the metabolic benefits of morning exercise aren't going to matter anyway.
Because so, you're not doing it.
So I think in terms of this, and I don't think we have the strong enough scientific evidence to say that to really get the biggest bang for your buck in the we should do it at a specific time of day. So I'd say whatever time works for you is the best time for health benefits.
Okay, so Amanda, I'm going to stay with you for a second here. We got a question from a listener over Twitter, at Schoon Carrington asks, quote, "My range of motion has gotten worse over the years with sitting down all day at the office. I've also lost some of my flexibility. Can they recommend some stretches to help improve the flexibility and undo some of the damage?" End quote. Not sure if you're the right person, but given your work with the mechanics of the body, I thought I'd start with you, Amanda.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think so, thinking about, you know, just sitting throughout the day, a lot of people have office work. And what we've shown in our previous research in terms of just like moving more and taking breaks throughout the day might just actually help that little bit more to kind of get you moving. So if it's possible to take just quick few minute breaks throughout the day, that could be beneficial to kind of just get the body moving and initiated. And then in terms of stretching activities, I think Steve might also have some suggestions on this, but consider, you know, whatever activities work best for you, whether it's just some simple yoga routine or anything that really works to get the body moving.
And Steve, where do you start, people who seem to have kind of permanently melded into their work chair, right, and are looking to stretch out from that?
Absolutely. I mean, something you can do in the interim, I mean, strength training is always going to be the best, a really good place to start to get those muscles in better positions. But an easy thing to think of is if you sit in a position, your muscles adapt to that position. So in a seated position, my quads get a little bit shorter.
That's
they hang.
The muscles on the front of your thighs.
Muscle on the front of the thighs. And the hamstrings in the back get a little lengthened. And what happens is you get up and you feel like you're trying to touch your toes and your hamstrings have no more rope to give you. They're already stretched out. So the thought is instead of stretching hamstrings because they feel tight, activate them, shorten them up, activate them. So put your legs in 90 degrees, turn them on a little bit, and give them some strength. It will pull away from the quads having all the attention and give you a little bit better position in the hips and the back, and you'll feel a little bit more comfortable.
No way, because that's like a big problem for me, and I did not know that
it's
answer.
It's absolutely true.
All right, so I'm going to stay with you for a second here, Steve. I am mindful of the fact that not everyone can go to a gym. Not everybody even has a physical space in their home, the apartment or the room that they live in, where they can stretch out and do yoga. So a couple of very practical things to keep your body moving and fit towards well-being that anyone can do.
I love that question. That's a great question because it's so easy to engage in these things, but people think they have to go to a gym. They have to be outside. What we do is, you know, if you have a habit you want to engage in, you want to reduce the friction to engage in that activity. So if you want to get in shape, gamify it a little bit. So I tell people, if you watch TV, you love watching TV, every time there's a commercial, stand up, do 10 air squats.
And what is an air squat?
Air squat. So think, just stay, you're standing in position, squat down to your butt's equal with your knees, stand back up. And what it's going to give you is, you know, you did 10 squats. And people say, well, is that enough to get in shape? And my response is it more than you did yesterday? And if that's the question, if that's the answer to the question, then yeah, next day, do 10 more squats. And before that, you're going to say, well, those 10 squats are too easy. I might need to add more things to this. And before you know it, you can do air squats. You can do push-ups. You can do a plank during commercials. Anything you can do to just engage a little bit today is going to set you on a path to do more the next day and the next day and the next day.
I think most people probably know what a push-up is, but a plank is, right, where you're either on your elbows or your hands and your toes and your body stretched out.
Yeah, you're trying to make yourself as rigid as possible. You can be on your elbows. You can also be on your knees to reduce how intense it is, but making your abs just wake up because they might not be awake during any given day.
All right, so Amanda, let's turn to the cult of fitness for a minute. And, you know, I think we've all been affected by it either positively or negatively in our lives in the last several decades. I personally, just in the arc of my life, date it back to when Jane Fonda exploded off of the movie screen and into exercise videos, sort of starting the whole thing. Today, we get a lot of conversation about 10,000 steps, right? You use one of those trackers, you're supposed to get 10,000 steps out of your day. And I understand you published a study on this. I'd really like to hear what you learned.
Yeah, absolutely. So to give you a little background, so 10,000 steps per day, it started about half a century ago. A pedometer was produced in Japan that roughly translated to 10,000 step meter, and it really stuck, and it has not been based in scientific evidence.
So it was never a thing in terms of science.
Exactly. It really did not start. You could think 10,000 steps is really a nice, clean number. People get it. You can track it. It's really nice. We wanted to actually get at how many steps do we need for health benefits? And so we started to look at this in terms of the number of steps that participants in these various studies were taking according to devices, like you could think of similar to a Fitbit. And we followed them for your risk of death. And so what we found was that as you take more steps per day, there's a progressively lower risk of death. And it tended to level at actually less than 10,000 steps per day for older adults in particular. So we saw as you got more steps per day, there was a reduction in risk until leveling. If you were older than 60, it was about 6,000 to 8,000 steps per day. Hmm. And if you were younger than 60, it was about 8,000 to 10,000 steps per day where this leveling occurred. So really what this study is saying is that you can get benefits at lower levels. If you're above 10,000, continue to do that. But if you're not quite there, there's still benefit. So that 10,000 step goal, if it's not quite achievable yet, don't feel deterred by that, I guess.
So that is super helpful. And I the number I'm taking away from it, to the extent that it's healthy to focus on a number, is more like 8,000, really.
Right. Yeah. If you could kind of split in the middle between those older and younger adults, 8,000 could be a reasonable goal for many individuals.
All right. So, Steve, last question over to you. Briefly describe for people, especially those who may be re-entering some kind of fitness or new, the difference between good pain and bad pain.
It's a great question. The first thing I say is, it's something I've told a lot of new clients is, week one heroes become week five burnouts. You know, you're going back to the gym, you start off, you go way too hard, you're trying to do everything in a week, and by week five, you're so exhausted and banged up that you're not going to be able to keep going and you fall right back into that habit. So start slow. Good pain is going to be more central in the muscles. You know, think of your joints. So knee to hip, somewhere in the middle of that, it's probably some good quad soreness. If your knees are really hurting, if your hip joints are really hurting, you probably overdid it. You might have gone too heavy, you know, too many reps. But soreness is great, but soreness is always not the determinant of a good workout. In the beginning, you'll be a little bit sore, but you know, 10 weeks in, if you're still getting really, really sore, I don't want you to chase that. I want you to feel good, but if you're really sore, you might have overdone it by far, you know, 10 weeks into it.
All right, so helpful. Steve McGuire, personal trainer, and Amanda Palook, assistant professor of kinesiology at UMass Amherst. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know that feeling when some situation or some piece of your life is so off, it is so messed up that you just have to laugh about it? Well, that is how Annalisa Quinn felt when she tried to find an apartment in Greater Boston. Kind of funny, not funny. So Quinn is trying to move here. She's bouncing around right now, but she's currently in Washington, D.C., and she got a job as an editor for the Boston Globe magazine. So it was time to relocate, or try to relocate. Now, let's put this in context for a second. According to an analysis by rental listing service company Zumper, the average cost of a one-bedroom apartment in Massachusetts was $2,075 in April. In Boston, $2,500, a little bit more. Back of the envelope, that is a roughly 20% increase compared to this time last year. So now, back to Annalisa, trying to find an apartment in this market. Going on her hunt, some of the options she discovered in her price range have been so, we'll use the word striking, that she wrote a piece about it in the Boston Globe magazine called "Want to Pay Less for an Apartment in Boston? Just Move in with a Nudist." So Annalisa Quinn joins us now. Hey, Annalisa, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we have talked about housing in a lot of different ways here on the show in the last few years, but there was something about your article that captured the zeitgeist for a lot of renters. Give us some of what you encountered in your price range.
So I love Craigslist housing ads because often people are just really upfront about who they are and what they want and what they're looking for. So yeah, as you mentioned, you know, there was this one guy in Quincy who's a nudist and he wants to live with somebody who's okay with that. And that was $700 a month, which is really cheap in Boston. And I almost feel like, you know, there's almost a nudist discount. Or there was a woman who's a practicing witch, which amazing. But I sort of love trawling around. You know, it feels like okay, all of the rich tapestry of humanity is contained on the Craigslist Boston housing ads, you know?
So and those are the people that you might live with, but there was also a lot that you came across just in terms of how much you can or can't get in a particular price range, like your own room, for example.
Totally. So I think the going price for a room in a house is about $1,000 a month, which is really high. But, you know, some of the ads that you see, I saw an ad on Facebook for you could pay $1,000 a month to sleep on somebody's couch in their living room. And now I'm sure that's illegal. And, you know, the comments were very angry. But, you know, clearly the situation is dire if that's even a plausible option.
So what kind of responses have you heard from readers? Has there been a lot of people saying that has what happened to me?
Yeah. No, I've gotten a lot of notes to that effect. But my favorite note came from a 98-year-old woman named Ethel who said I could share her independent living apartment. So I thought that was very sweet.
You going to take her up on it?
I'm thinking about it. I mean, I'm not sure. Not exactly sure if I'm 31. I'm not sure if there are sort of age requirements for her her building, but
all right. So listen, I do want to backtrack for a second. You, as I understand it, you actually have not yet found a place that meets what you want and is in your price range. Is that correct?
Well, so I'm still looking. I did find a great place, but then the Globe, they pushed back their reopening date. So I have a little bit of time to figure it out.
So why not take that place, though, if it's the one that meets your needs?
I just don't know when the office will reopen, and I think I don't really want to move until I'm pretty sure I'll be able to go in. But it was a really great place, but it was, I think, $1,700 a month for a room with its own bathroom, and it was a gorgeous place, but, you know, paying that sort of regularly while not actually having to be in Boston doesn't
okay.
make a lot of sense.
So there's the meat of it, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. the meat of it. And what's interesting is that you know a lot of different rental markets, Berlin, for example, D.C. How does our rental market compare with what you've experienced recently elsewhere?
Well, it's funny. So I've lived in some of the most expensive cities in the world. You know, I used to be a freelance journalist, and so I was always traveling. So I've lived in London, I've lived in Berlin and Munich and DC and New York, and I've never had quite so much trouble, actually. And I think everywhere right now, the rental market is nuts. It's also nuts in New York and DC, for example. But, you know, I was living in Berlin until recently, and you could get a beautiful one-bedroom apartment in a nice neighborhood for, you know, about €1,000 a month or a bit less. And people in Berlin are really complaining about how high that is. But it's just astronomical in Boston in comparison.
So, we've talked a lot about affordability of housing here on the show in the last couple of years. There's a dignity dimension to all of this, too. Reading your article mm-hmm. made me remember when my family and I, we were looking for our first house to own with little kids, we found a place and we went in and there was a Ziggy doll, the old Ziggy doll, hanging by a noose around his neck off a light fixture in a bedroom. And that was like
oh my God.
What we could afford. I mean, bad spirits, you know. But I remember standing in that room and thinking, we can afford what we can afford. So what could we do with this? Now, that is not the house that we bought, but this... I do want to connect for a moment to the idea that people want housing that they feel good about, that they can feel safe in and comfortable in. And this market makes it hard to do that. Did you feel hurt, you know, by trying to come to a new place and saying, wait a minute, I can't afford this?
Well, I think that's the thing is, you know, my piece was sort of jokey, but the truth is that the people who are going to be affected by this rental market are low-income people or, you know, students. I think particularly, you know, when I saw that ad for the $1,000, you know, living room sleeping situation, I just really hoped that, I don't know, some international student wasn't going to end up there because they didn't really have the resources or like the language to navigate the rental market. So I think, you know, as you say, it is a question of dignity. I mean, I think personally, I'm lucky. You know, I have this job at the Globe, and I'm sure I can find a perfectly nice room and a perfectly nice house. But it definitely makes me aware of how many people that must not be true for, just when prices look like this. And some of the, I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, they're so expensive. Then you look at these places, and they're a lot of them are really run down as well. And, you know, if you have to live with animals or you're, you know, like rodents or there's dirt or you don't feel safe, the doors don't lock, that kind of thing. That actually did happen. I almost took a room, but then it turned out the doors didn't lock to the
that could be a deal
outside
breaker.
Of the house, which.
Yeah. Okay. So Annalisa Quinn, apartment listing connoisseur and articles editor for the Boston Globe magazine. Annalisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Salem Witch Museum. It turns 50 today. And in that half a century, the institution has taught countless visitors about the dark chapter of Massachusetts history that saw 19 people, mostly women, hanged for alleged witchcraft between February of 1692 and May of 1693. Now, 300 years since the Salem witch trials, the word witch and its weight have a myriad of meanings. We talked about that last October when we took a look at an exhibit about witches called The Salem Witch Trials, Reckoning and Reclaiming. We sat down then with Associate Museum Curator Lydia Gordon at the Peabody Essex Museum, which curated the exhibit, and photographer Frances Denny, whose photos of modern-day witches were featured. And I asked Frances to tell us about who today's witches are.
It is hard to generalize, right? Because there are so many different kinds of ways of embodying this word witch. Pictured in these images, you have Wiccan high priestesses. You have people who would consider themselves pagan, many who don't consider themselves pagan. There are people who practice mysticism or engage with the occult. There are politically oriented activist witches. Polytheists also who work within a pantheon of goddesses. There are tarot readers, astrologers, people who practice spellcraft, and quite a few plant-based healers who sometimes go by the moniker of Green Witch. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a sense of the breadth of the way that people have come to this word and reclaimed it for themselves.
So Lydia, I want to note Frances's book, where these pictures came from, is called Major Arcana, Portraits of Witches in America. Frances just gave us a very wide-ranging sample of women who could be witches. And this exhibit is to reclaim the word of witch. That's a central theme. So I'm going to be deliberately kind of obtuse for a minute here. How can all of that be a witch?
Right. Well, I think Frances spoke really eloquently about her project in so that it is a spectrum of identity. You know, the contemporary witch identity that these folks are really self, you know, claiming for themselves is a spectrum. It's a pantheon. No one witch is exactly the same. And it's really important to understand that our understanding of a witch is very different today than it was in the 17th century, right? In the 17th century Puritan context, a witch was somebody that was working alongside the devil, right? Like against the Christian church. And what Frances's project really does quite beautifully, elegantly, and powerfully is diversify our perception of witches today, as well as reclaim that power and that word from, you know, this really baggaged history.
The exhibit, Lydia, also focuses on the baggaged history. And I guess I'm assuming that most of us know the Salem witch trials were bogus at this point, but is that a safe assumption?
I mean, it was a crisis made up of hysteria and founded on people who were really in it for land grabs and money. And there were all these sort of conflicting arenas in Salem. And what is very evident in looking at this history and doing the research is that, you know, no one was safe from being accused. This wave of crisis really went across all social strata, but it is significant that most of the people, not all, but most of them who were accused and tried and executed were women.
So Frances, it kind of blew my mind to find out that you are both a descendant of someone responsible for condemning accused witches in Salem and a descendant of an accused witch. What does it feel? How do you carry around both of those contradictions, right, in your DNA? And how did that motivate your work?
Yeah, when I made that discovery, looking through my family tree, it felt irreconcilable. It was not something I could, you know, seal up in an envelope and get rid of in the mail. You know, it was something that stuck with me. And in fact, I kind of tucked it away because I knew that I needed to come back to it at a later date and really focus my art on it. And that's exactly what I did. I got interested in this word witch and how it has sort of traveled through time, acquiring all of this baggage. You know, you have the Spanish Inquisition, the Salem witch trials, the Brothers Grimm fairy tales with the hag in the woods preying on children. And then you look at the 20th century, you have the Disney witch with green skin and a hooked nose and a pointy hat, and the television shows around witches. And so, you know, as I thought more deeply about this word and how it's traveled through time, I thought, well, aren't there people who identify as witches now? Because I truly didn't know much about this contemporary world of witchcraft at all.
And briefly, how did you find them, Frances?
Mm-hmm. So I started by writing a letter of intent, kind of an artist statement, and I sent it to a few individuals that I sort of had a hunch about, that I thought would sort of understand what I was after, who I wouldn't completely offend by sending this letter. And lo and behold, they did agree to be photographed and interviewed for the project. And then they ended up introducing me, or sort of referring me, to coven mates or friends. And from there, the project really grew really quickly. It became this massive web sort of spanning the U.S. And I ended up photographing over 75 individuals around the country who identify as witches.
So Lydia, tell us, there are two other parts to this exhibit. Maybe tell us about those two other parts by telling us about some item in each one of those two other parts.
Sure. So the other contemporary artist in the exhibition is the fashion designer Alexander McQueen. And McQueen was actually a descendant as well from an accused individual in the Salem witch trials named Elizabeth Howe. And he did his research to find out what her situation was and her trial and what she was being accused of. And he ended up creating an entire collection in 2007 in her memory. And so we own one of the spectacular gowns from that collection, and that is featured as well in the exhibition. And then the first part, really, of the show and the experience is 1692. So we really try to ground visitors in that history. And we have a vignette of 17th century objects that greets the visitors to sort of give a sense of what it was like to live in Salem back then, which was a very scary place. And we have this incredible window that was part of E. Putnam's house, and it would sort of reflect this idea of living inside and outside and peering through, and hysteria and, you know, sort of gossip and not quite knowing where you are, who you can trust. Mm. And so the whole experience of the exhibition is quite emotional, and we try to go from this sort of darkness to lightness.
I believe that the dress that you're describing, there's a picture of the neckline of that dress on the website for the exhibit. It's all beaded and high-necked and dark and I don't know, there's something powerful about it.
Oh, yeah. It's totally fierce. I mean,
yeah, that's the word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is, you know, he's not really holding back. And, you know, there's so much about when you wear something that makes you feel good, you know, you're kind of arming yourself, right? And I absolutely get that sense when I experience that show-stopping piece.
So, Frances, I heard you say, mm-hmm. And so now that we've introduced this word fierceness, riff on that with your work.
Well, I mean, just about McQueen and his work for a moment, I think that he understood how there is a power in fearfulness and fearsomeness. He embraced that in his design. He armed women, as Lydia said. So I think that the people that I photographed have also sort of armed themselves in a sense with their witchcraft, because I think at its essence, witchcraft is really about the cultivation of an inner power. It's about being in tune with oneself and with the earth, and for finding kind of alternative systems for processing the world around us, the energy around us. And, you know, I think in a time when so many of us feel a great deal of powerlessness, you know, in the face of a global pandemic and political unrest, I hope that visitors to the show will be moved by the ways in which my subjects have found ways to navigate life with more magic and wisdom.
So, Lydia, not to put too fine a point on it, but listening to Frances there, I find myself thinking this exhibit takes us from a time where if you were a powerful woman, it could get you hanged, to a time when we have women Marvel superheroes. So I wonder, has the change in our understanding of the word and the concept witch mirrored our changing understanding of what it means to be a woman?
I mean, I think that that question and that identity is always in flux and it's ever expanding, right? I mean, it's wonderful that we have more representation in the media, in our lives, especially in the museum world and art. We see ourselves in a whole spectrum in, you know, diverse experience being represented and celebrated. But, you know, the war on women has still not ended, right? It manifests perhaps differently now, but that fear and control is still very much there in our culture.
That was Peabody Essex Museum Associate Curator Lydia Gordon and photographer Frances Denny, whose photos of modern-day witches are published in her book, Major Arcana, Portraits of Witches in America. All right, as we close the show today, two quick notes for you. First, Radio Boston is moving. We will air live at 11 a.m. beginning next Monday, May 9th. You can catch us again at 3, and you can always stream us online or where you get your favorite podcasts. And we are excited to move to 11 and help WBUR make mornings better. And we are looking to connect more directly with you. Please sign up for our texting group so we can give you heads up about what's coming, hear your thoughts on our stories, and bring your comments to our air. To get started, you text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Again, to get started, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. We are really looking forward to hearing from you. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Francisca Monahan, Sarah Leeson, and Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.